This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Virginia lawmakers have embarked on a four-year effort to improve mental health across the Commonwealth. The man in charge of that venture wants Virginia to end up a national leader in how states treat people who are mentally ill. One of this hour's guests is likely to play a key role. Economist Stephen Stern has been developing new models for measuring the need for mental health services. He's already done a test run in one region of Virginia and now is working on similar studies across the state. So how do you measure a population's need for mental health treatment? How do you meet that need? How do you know if you're succeeding? In addition to Dr. Stern, we have two more guests with long experience in mental health advocacy. And then we have you. If you have any thoughts on how state and local governments can better approach mental health treatment, you'll certainly be welcome to join in when our conversation begins right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. How do you best estimate a population's need for mental health treatment? Here in the Insight studio with me, Professor of Economics from the University of Virginia, Stephen Stern, plus Donna Gumm, Executive Director of the Augusta County Chapter of Mental Health America, as well as the Executive Director of the advocacy group Voices for Virginia's Children, Margaret Nimmo Crow. Thank you all for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be back.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this.
And glad to be here. This is my first time.
Margaret's been here before. This is your first time, Donna, and this is Steve's first time. So, Dr. Stern, let me pick on you first, because you actually have already done a sort of pilot study of mental health needs in one region of Virginia. I was hoping you could tell us more about just what you did and what you found.
Okay. So the bottom line is that it's very difficult to measure the need for mental health services because there's no easy way to do a survey and ask people whether they have a mental health problem. There are some national surveys that have done that. And with those national surveys, you can measure what type of other characteristics make it more likely that you're going to have a mental health problem. So, for example, veterans are more likely to have mental health problems than people who are not veterans. Given that relationship that you can estimate with national surveys, we can then take those estimated relationships along with information about the local population to predict how many people locally have a mental health problem. So I did that. I took national data to estimate those relationships, and then I applied it to Central Virginia. And what I found was, first of all, it matters a lot which national survey you use to estimate those relationships. One that came from the mid-90s leads to a overall average of about 10% of the population having a mental health problem. And the more...
At least a mental health problem serious enough that they could benefit from some sort of treatment. Is that...
They identified themselves as having a mental health problem.
So that was the lower end, the 10%.
Right. And then based on more recent surveys where the definition or the method of identifying people with mental health problems has changed a lot, the proportion is more like 30%. I used both of those, and then I compared those to the amount of provision of public mental health services in the Central Virginia area, and found that even if you use the more conservative estimate of around 10%, you still find that about half of the individuals who are identified as having a mental health problem are receiving help and half are not. And so that's a pretty large number of people who need help who are not getting it.
And Dr. Stephen Stern, just to clarify, when you're talking about public mental health services, implied in that is people who either do not have any kind of health insurance, don't have very good health insurance, and certainly are not financially able to pay for treatment on their own. So they're relying on some sort of government-supplied mental health service.
That's correct.
And so what you found in the Region 10 area, was it? It was the greater Charlottesville region.
Right.
Which
Charlottesville and surrounding five counties.
is that about half of those, from the very most conservative estimates, about half of those who would need some sort of help because they are too poor to pay for it themselves cannot get it.
Right.
What about, did you look at people who do have health insurance or who are financially able to pay for their own treatment?
I did do that, but in more of a back of the envelope type of way. And what I found was that there are enough services for people who have private health insurance.
And what?
And again, in the central Virginia area. In other parts of the state, that's probably not going to be the case.
What age range were you looking at in this pilot study?
I'm looking at only adults.
So 21 and above?
Yeah.
So I think that's really interesting, a very interesting finding, because what we find at
this
Voices.
This is Margaret Nimmo Crow from Voices for Virginia's Children.
Thank you. When we look at the needs for children, the national estimates are that 1 in 5 kids has a mental health disorder, and that only about 20% of those children are actually getting the help that they need. But then the Department of Behavioral Health at the state level estimates about 130,000 children in Virginia have a serious mental health disorder, the way they classify it. So the numbers definitely vary a little bit, as Dr. Stern said. But I think one of the things that's very different for children's services is that it's not just based on your socioeconomic status or your insurance status, whether or not services are available to you. I hear from middle-class families all the time who have difficulty finding treatment for their kids who have very serious mental health diagnoses. And despite the fact that they have private insurance, despite the fact that they have, you know, good jobs and are fairly savvy about where to go to get help, they still have trouble accessing the services that their kids need until the point that their children are in crisis.
So actually, I think I'm going to find the same thing once I look at other parts of the state. Remember that the Region 10 area has 2 high-quality hospitals and is a good place for people providing medical services in general and mental health services to live. So we have a lot. In other parts of the state, a big part of that problem is going to occur just because there's a significant shortage of healthcare providers, and in particular, mental healthcare providers.
The number, some people say that
this is
1 in 4 people have a mental illness. But remember, that ripples out because it affects not only the person that has the mental illness, but family members, their friends, people that they work with. So that in itself can affect. And that's why we work on the stigma issue so much with Mental Health America of Augusta. Your newspaper article from your abstract article mentioned stigma at the end, and that's really key for people to overcome that stigma to seek mental health services.
And that may be something that will play a part in you listening, whether or not you decide to participate in this discussion. But if you have any thoughts on anything that you hear, anything related to mental health treatment that you'd like to hear us discuss, any questions, you can reach us on Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Our guests, Margaret Nimmo Crow, Executive Director of the advocacy group Voices for Virginia's Children, Donna Gumm, Executive Director of the Augusta County Chapter of the national group Mental Health America, plus Stephen Stern, the Bankard Professor of Economics at the University of Virginia. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Margaret, going back to something that you were talking about, that the state of Virginia's definition of young people in serious need of mental health treatment, 130,000, I think you said, children who have some form of serious mental illness. Is there any estimate on how many of those children are able to get adequate treatment?
You know, Tom, it's a really difficult thing to measure because the system is both public and private. So we have community services boards, which are the public agencies that provide services. But we also have a lot of private, some are for-profit and some are nonprofit mental health treatment providers. So I think it's very difficult to figure out exactly who is getting reached.
And the other issue is that some of it's provided by people who are not mental health providers, and like pediatricians.
True. That's true. So it's a very it's sort of hard to get your hands around what exactly is the mental health system. But I think we know from a study that was done for the General Assembly a couple of years ago, where the Virginia Department of Behavioral Health did a study of all the community services boards, what services, what treatment modalities are available for kids around the state, and is there enough of any given service, or do they have to have wait lists? And what we found is that there is a huge lack of capacity. It varies tremendously from one region to the next, what is available. And even in areas that have a fairly robust array of children's mental health treatment, the wait list can be long because they don't have enough capacity. So once they reach a certain capacity, they only have one or two clinicians providing that particular service, then everybody else gets put on a wait list. And if your child is in a mental health crisis, being told that the next available appointment's in 3 or 4 months, you know, really does you no good. And then we get right back to that situation where families are in crisis and having to look at options like hospitalization. And there's no reason for so many families in Virginia to get to that point.
There is this thing called the Joint Subcommittee to Study Mental Health Services in the Commonwealth in the 21st Century. That's its official name. It's generally being thought of as the new Commission on Mental Health in Virginia. It's made up of state legislators. I think it's 7 members of the House of Delegates, 5 members of the state Senate. It is chaired by Cree Deeds, the state senator from Bath County, who, of course, was involved in that terrible tragedy last November when he was attacked by his son, and then his son killed himself after apparently being released early. And not being held for an appropriate length of time by a hospital who was looking at his mental health trauma. And that's led to certainly a ripple effect of new concern and new commitment to deal with availability of mental health treatment. But this new commission, Margaret Nimmo-Crow, you testified before its first meeting just a few weeks ago, and I understand that you've been tracking their work and the hopes that these people have quite closely. What can you tell us about this?
Well, I did go to the first meeting, Tom, and provided public comment on behalf of Voices for Virginia's Children. I think what's really gives me hope about this commission is that it is chaired by someone who is obviously highly motivated to reform the system. And not surprisingly, in this last General Assembly session, really all of the energy to reform the system was focused on that very narrow issue of what happens when someone is detained under an emergency custody order. And that really absorbed everyone's attention. But as we know, those of us who work in the field and have ever known anyone to go through the mental health system, the issues are much larger than that. That is one point in time in a whole continuum of services. And while it is crucially important that we get it right at that point in time, there are so many things that we could be doing to provide treatment to kids and adults well before they get to the point of crisis. So I'm very hopeful that this commission, with the makeup that it has and the time frame that it has, a 4-year window, is really going to be able to delve into some of these long-term issues and look at how do we provide community-based care so that the people who need it are really able to access what they need before they get into crisis. And I was also, just as a child advocate, encouraged that Senator Deeds talked about forming 4 different work groups, and one of those will be looking at children's behavioral health issues.
Senator Deeds was invited to participate in this discussion today, but his office told us that his schedule would not allow. He has been a friend of the show and has been on often in the past, so we certainly are hoping to hear from him soon as well. But I'm sorry, Stephen, you were saying?
Yeah, I'm not as optimistic, actually. I think the legislators who are involved have good intentions. There are some other big picture, long run problems that I think are going to get in the way of that. In particular, Medicaid is...
Oh, that's a great issue for us to get to. And since we've only got 10 seconds before we're going to hit the break,
okay,
let's save lots of time to get to that with economist Stephen Stern, Margaret Nimmo-Crow from Voices for Virginia's Children, and Donna Gum from Mental Health America. So to you who are listening, how much responsibility do you think state government has to make sure those needing mental health treatment can get that care? How well do you believe any such responsibility is being met here in Virginia? On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Donna Gum, leader of the Augusta County chapter of Mental Health America, is one of our guests. Stephen Stern, economist from the University of Virginia, is another. And rounding out our panel, the leader of the group Voices for Virginia's Children, Margaret Nimmo Crow. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Stephen Stern, Medicaid.
Okay, so there aren't that many things that all economists agree on, but one of the things that is almost unanimous agreement on is that Medicaid and Medicare are growing too much to be sustainable in the long run. And lots of states, including Virginia, are already seeing its effect on the state fiscal situation. And so there's a tremendous amount of pressure on the state legislature to figure out ways to rein in spending on Medicaid. The state has to pay for, I think, about half of Medicaid expenditures, and that represents a large and growing part of the of state expenditures, and that's just not going to work in the long run. So we have to find some other way of doing that. Mental health expenditures are a relatively small part, but the state has treated mental health as just another part of Medicaid expenditures. Over the last couple of years, there have been a lot of efforts to privatize Medicaid spending, and there's been talk about how that's going to lead to efficiency, but I don't see that. I think it's just going to lead to less service, or it's just not going to work.
Well, I think it's important to note that the huge growth in Medicaid spending, most of the spending in Medicaid is on the elderly and disabled, although most of the enrollees are the children, but they're not the expensive ones, and the mental health services are, in fact, not the most expensive services.
Mental health services are not, but we're still not doing a great job of disentangling those two.
True.
So I think that's going to be a really critical point for the state legislature, and it's going to make it hard for advocates to ask for more money for mental health services or any other medical services.
But access to care for all Virginians needing mental health services or physical services. Mental health is just as important as a physical need. It is a disease like a physical illness, and it deserves the same kind of treatment. It deserves the same kind of insurance and the same kind of care as a medical disease deserves as well. Something needs to be done. General Assembly needs to come to grips with this. It needs to be quit being a political football and look at it as care for all and not just for a particular group of people.
Donna, I couldn't agree more. This is Margaret. I think that when we look at the most efficient and economical ways, though I am not an economist, to treat folks who have serious mental illness, we looked at this issue during the last session with NAMI, Virginia, MHA, and others, that of the uninsured who fall in the coverage gap, these are adults.
NAMI is...
The National Alliance on Mental Illness and Mental Health America of Virginia and other partners, we looked at what those statistics are, and they're talking about 400,000 roughly adults who fall into that coverage gap and are currently without insurance, and about 77,000 of them have a serious mental health issue that is not being treated. So they're at the mercy of community services boards, the public mental health system, which has very limited funding to serve the uninsured. Another important avenue for looking at sort of who is in that 400,000 of uninsured folks, one-fourth of those, Tom, are actually parents of kids under the age of 18. You can imagine if a parent caring for young children has an untreated mental health disorder, that has a ripple effect, like you were talking about, Donna, on the entire family. It can bankrupt the family, for one thing, any sort of medical emergency. But also maternal depression has a huge effect on the development of young children. So we're really... these are not long-term savings when we leave people untreated with serious mental health issues.
Actually, even in the short run, they're not savings because in many cases, the alternative is state psychiatric hospitals, which are really expensive, or jail, which is also really expensive.
And I wanted to ask you about cost versus benefit, as long as you are the economist on the panel, Dr. Stephen Stern. It's my understanding that this first meeting of the new mental health commission that occurred a few weeks ago, at which Margaret was one of those people who testified. One of the others is the former state inspector general for the Virginia Department of Behavioral Health, which oversees mental health services across the state. And if I'm recalling correctly, his testimony, one of the things that he said is that upwards of a quarter of the people who are in regional jails across the state have a mental illness.
Yeah. And at this point, the biggest provider of mental health services is the prison system.
But they don't provide much in terms of mental health service, do they?
But it's not adequate.
Right.
Donna Gum.
So in terms of talking about cost benefit, do you have some sense of how much it costs to keep someone in prison as a result of their having a mental illness versus their getting appropriate treatment somewhere else?
I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's not in the same ballpark.
So it's much more costly to put them in jail?
Yes.
Yes.
This is why in our area they have begun mental health court for people that are arrested with a misdemeanor, that they can put them through this process. It's about a year process, three phases, instead of putting them in jail. And as long as they go through the process, attend group meetings, take their meds, meet appointments, are working or looking for work, well, then they can stay in this program, and it's most beneficial. It's been proven in Roanoke and Roanoke County, which is where the Augusta County group has gone to see. I am now a member of the advisory board, and we look for this to be beneficial in our area.
And I think it just makes sense if you're treating some of the underlying problems that have caused someone to become involved in the criminal or the juvenile justice system, the recidivism rate's just going to go down. So
right.
That expense is not perhaps just for incarcerating the person this time, but if they have a substance abuse issue, perhaps caused by an underlying untreated mental health disorder, the chances of recidivism are very high. So it certainly just makes so much more sense to
right.
approach it the way drug courts do and mental health courts and trying to sort of treat that underlying issue.
The vice chair of this new commission is Republican delegate from Albemarle County, Rob Bell, who also has a history in his time in the General Assembly of pushing for improvements in the mental health system in Virginia. One of the things that I read about his saying was it just seemed as if he was questioning whether the entire system needs to be reworked or rethought in terms of community service boards. And maybe you could explain a little bit, Margaret, about how the community service boards work, how they're supposed to work in Virginia, and what the frustration is from people like Delegate Bell.
Sure. It's a very emotional issue. People are very frustrated. However, I think that it is important to look back at why they were formed. It was during the time when we were deinstitutionalizing people and trying to provide more community-based care. And unfortunately, some of the things that happened were that we did not mandate any particular services other than case management and emergency services. And the case management is only as funds allow. So other than that and some discharge planning from the hospitalization, there is nothing in state code that CSBs have to do. And so it's really at the mercy of state and local funding. And so you can't expect a system to do all and be all and serve all of these hundreds of thousands of people we've just been talking about, children and adults who have a serious mental health issue, if you're not funded to do that. And the local funding ranges anywhere from like 2% of a community services board budget up to Fairfax County, which I think is
70.
Okay, I was going to say half. I was very conservative on that. So I think there's a great deal of difference in local support, which is part of the reason why it's an accident of where you live, what's available to you.
Right.
And part of that, I think, is because we've set up the system in a way so that local governments have a big incentive not to provide funds. Basically, Medicaid is becoming the big provider, and local governments really just don't feel they want to or have to get involved.
Well, somewhere in our audience right now is someone who has struggled with getting appropriate mental health treatment, either for themselves or for a loved one. If you are that person and you'd be willing to share your story with us, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA. Talk. Donna Gum, leader of the Augusta County Chapter of Mental Health America, is with us, as is Stephen Stern, economist from the University of Virginia, and Margaret Nimmo Crow, executive director of Voices for Virginia's Children. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Let's go to Waynesboro. Liz, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Hi. I have actually a lot of experience in the mental health system. I have a family member with a mental illness, and I was former board president for NAMI here in the area, and also worked at a mental health facility in the area. So I just wanted to comment that, in my experience, one of the most beneficial things for a person with a long-term serious mental illness is like DAP funding to help people have long-term sustainable housing. For my family, my loved one, she went through a horrible cycle of hospitalization and even getting like a criminal record until she got stable housing. And then since then, she's not had any recidivism back into the hospital or the jail system.
Liz, this is Margaret Nimmo Crow at Voices. I think you have actually hit on something that's so important, which is the supportive services for people who have mental health issues, and particularly for adults. I hear about housing all the time being a huge barrier. If you don't have a stable place to live, it's really hard to make anything else work out. And so that's something that mental health advocates have really been working on, is trying to get people the funds that she was talking about, the DAP funds, another one of our acronyms, Tom, discharge assistance planning. So for folks coming out of a state hospital, making sure that they have some place to go and all the treatment that they need to wrap around to make sure that they can stay in that housing. And people do need support. People who have a serious mental health disorder, a diagnosis like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, that is a chronic condition that they're going to be living with. But what we know is that they can recover and they can be successful. But some folks are going to need some long-term support. So it's great to hear that someone has found some housing and some other intensive supports that have enabled them to live in the community successfully. I think that's what we want for everyone.
Liz, how much responsibility do you see state and local government having for getting treatment to people who can't afford to pay for it themselves?
Well, as the system is set up now, it's almost solely the government's responsibility, state and local. And just like someone commented earlier, it's just the lack of funding, and it's not for a lack of wanting to see it be that way, but there's just, it's almost like you're kind of rubbing two sticks together a lot of times, and there's just there's not enough resources, there's not enough money, and it gets spread so thin that so many people fall through the cracks. And I think I'm glad somebody brought up the issue of folks ending up in jail, because that is a huge thing. So it is definitely the responsibility of local and state government, but it's hard.
Last year, a General Assembly,
this is Donna Gum.
Added more money for DAP funding, which we were happy to see. I just came off of the local human rights committee at Western State Hospital, and we saw the barriers to discharge list each month. And as more money was put into DAP funding, we saw that list go down, because housing was one of the number one barriers of people being discharged, that and getting the DAP funding and employment. So we were glad to see more DAP funding added, but there's still more room for improvement.
Well, there's huge room for improvement. And Tom, I'm really worried, honestly, because there was an infusion of money put in just this last session for adult and children's mental health services, but we just heard a report from the governor about how bad the next biennial budget looks. We're going to have to cut more than $1 billion more out of the budget than we had anticipated, and there were already cuts in June. And the mental health money so far, the new money, has been protected. But I think going forward, they're going to have to be more cuts. And unfortunately, what we saw after Virginia Tech is that there was an infusion of money, and then the recession hit, and it all plus some came back out of the system. So we really haven't had any forward progress in a very long time. And I think I have to put on my advocacy hat, because I think all of us who care about mental health issues and know and love someone who might have a mental health disorder need to let our legislators know that this is important and that we vote and that we care.
Liz, thank you so very much for taking time to share some of your perspective with us. To you on the other side of your radio, one of the key arguments from those who advocate for better mental health services seems to be along the lines of pay something now or pay much more later. The idea being that treating a mental health need early is much more cost-effective than waiting until it might become a much more serious illness. So you can reach us on Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Margaret Nimmo-Crowe, our economist, Stephen Stern, was explaining that in this pilot study that he was doing for the greater Charlottesville area, the area served by something called the Region 10 Community Services Board, one of the things that he found and sort of a back-of-the-envelope calculation is that for people who have private health insurance or who are fairly well off, there are the services for them that they can get. It's the poor who are challenged because they have to try and get in line for the limited public services provided by taxpayers and government. It's my understanding, Margaret, that you may have a little bit different view because there are some things that people sometimes need that fall between going to a counselor once a week, which private health insurance often pays for, or ending up being hospitalized, which health insurance often pays for. Stuff in the middle that does not, that even people who have good health insurance can't get?
Absolutely, Tom. I think the picture is really different for kids. And one reason it's different is that there are many more children covered by Medicaid and FAMIS, which is the health insurance provided by the state for low-income working families. So it goes up to 200% of the federal poverty level. So first of all, we have a much bigger universe of children who have some public insurance than we do adults. So that's one reason it's very different. The other is that Medicaid and FAMIS actually pay for those intermediate level services you were just talking about, what falls between counseling and hospitalization.
Describe some of those.
So these are things like intensive in-home services, having a therapist come to your house and work a lot of hours during the week, 10 to 15 hours during the week, after school, in the morning, whenever it is that your family and child are experiencing a difficulty, and working with the child and family to really work through some of those issues and get you back on a more stable place. Therapeutic day treatment is another service that's often available in schools to help children be able to stay in their home school and not have to go to a private day treatment school or a residential option. Also, case management, a very basic service. Children have oftentimes pediatricians, counselors, someone working with them at school, and no one coordinating these services. Medicaid pays for a case manager. So these are things that can really help make a difference in terms of the functioning and the success of these students in school.
And you would argue that when it comes to adults who can't get this through their health insurance, there also is a cost-effectiveness argument because it's more cost-effective to do those intermediary things rather than end up hospitalized?
Right, and adults can't get them, but also kids whose parents have private insurance can't get those things either.
We'll talk more in just a bit more than 1 minute. Stephen Stern is a former chair of the Region 10 Community Services Board, the group charged with providing public mental health services for the greater Charlottesville area. Dr. Stern, an economist, recently developed a new statistical model for measuring the extent of mental health needs in regional populations. Mental Health America is made up of local and regional chapters across the country which advocate for people in need of mental health treatment. Donna Gum is executive director of the Augusta County chapter. Voices for Virginia's Children is a statewide organization that has long won praise from all sides of the political aisle for its advocacy work for children. Much of that effort is focused on improving access to mental health care for kids. Margaret Nimmo-Crowe is executive director at Voices. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And Margaret Nimmo-Crowe, it's my understanding that somebody from James Madison University has just been honored with a quite significant award from your organization.
Yes, Tom, I'm really excited to tell your listening audience that Dr. Joanne Grayson, Professor Emeritus at JMU, is going to be awarded our Carol S. Fox Making Kids Count Award on October 7th.
Professor of Psychology?
Yes, and we just let her know this on Friday. We surprised her with the news. It's a huge honor. This is our third year of giving out these awards, and the purpose is to recognize an individual and an organization around Virginia who are really lifting up children's issues. And Dr. Grayson, for anyone who knows her, has spent her lifetime doing that, huge researcher and teacher in terms of trying to train folks to deal with kids who've been abused and neglected. She's made a huge difference in Virginia. She actually edits and publishes the Virginia Child Protection Newsletter, which educates those in the field and has for many years. We're really excited to present this award to her on October 7th and encourage anybody listening who wants to support her to go to our website to learn more. That's vakids.org.
Donna Gumm, being reminded of Dr. Grayson's work, Dr. Grayson has been a guest on this show in the past, leads me to wonder about how much is being done, in your view, for prevention, for keeping children maybe, or anybody who may be showing signs of having a mental health problem, from getting worse.
Not a lot. I know our CSB does some work with at-risk children.
And again, CSB is a Community Services Board, which is what, for different regions the state, is in charge of providing public mental health services.
And then our organization does some prevention work also with programming. The new commissioner, Dr. Deborah K. Ferguson, Department of Developmental Services and Behavioral Health.
This is for the state of Virginia.
For the state of Virginia. Prevention came out of her mouth, and I was so happy to hear that, because we have said an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And so it's like a breath of fresh air to hear that. Margaret says that she has done some prevention work when she was in Chicago before she came here. And she will be our annual meeting speaker on November 14th.
Donna, I think you're right.
Glad to have you.
Dr. Ferguson, we're very excited to meet with her because she has a background in forensic psychology, working with the juvenile population in Illinois. So she really understands what happens when you don't do early intervention and prevention, and she is very focused on that. I've now heard her present to several legislative committees and commissions, and at every presentation, she mentions the importance of intervening early, and especially working with children, because that is something that's really been overlooked in Virginia for many years.
So can I ask a question in the sense of not knowing?
Sure.
How do you identify children who are at risk in that sense?
Behavior.
A lot of it can be behavior. But even before that, there are certain things that we know can be risk factors. So growing up in poverty, we know, can put kids at risk. Living in an environment of toxic stress where there's not enough to eat, there's violence in the neighborhood, all of those sorts of things. There's also been a widespread study I'm sure you've heard of called the ACEs study, which is Adverse Childhood Experiences, and it's followed a huge cohort of folks throughout their lifetime and seen that the number of adverse childhood experiences that you have has a direct correlation to health problems, including mental health, but also physical health problems later in life. And so they've been able to study over time, and the more of those risk factors you have, and it could be things like parent mental health problems, parent substance abuse, divorce, violence, all kinds of things that could happen to children, the more of those that add up, the greater the risk. So there are ways of identifying through sort of a public health model who are some of these kids that we think are going to be at risk, and what are some of the things we can do to screen those kids and figure out who might need further assessment, who might need further help. There's some other great programs that that Voices looks at even before the kids get to an age where you can screen them, and those have to do with vulnerable families. And there are programs in Virginia for which we advocate called Healthy Families and CHIP of Virginia that go in and do home visiting. So they work on the parent-child attachment. They even start with pregnant moms before the child is born to talk about child development and what it's going to be like once the baby's there, and then helping them really bond, because it's kind of surprising when you think of babies that they have mental health, but they do. Social and emotional development of children is very important. And when you look at infants, the attachment that they have to a caregiver actually has an effect on the trajectory of their whole lives. So I think when we look at the world of prevention and early intervention, there are really a lot of things we can do if we just think more broadly about what is included in that.
So I think it's a little bit hard to measure how effective those programs are in the longer run. In other words, if you're providing either a kid or the family of a kid with services when they're two, do we see any changes, measurable changes in behavior when they're 18?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. And I think the way I would encourage you to see it is, rather than as a marathon, think of it as a relay. So there's a lot of question about, do things work when kids are young? Well, the first thing you're trying to do is perhaps get them ready for kindergarten. So look at that transition and that handoff, and then look at what happens to them when they're in elementary years and then the next handoff, rather than necessarily is the one intervention that they got when they were 6 months old going to mean that they're not going to end up in jail when they're 30. Well, I'm not sure that you can expect anything to sort of have that long-term impact if nothing happens in between those two times. So I think we need to look at these programs, which, by the way, do have rigorous evaluation done of them, but they look at things that are a little bit nearer term.
Yeah, usually when the kids are about seven, I think.
Because they're hurdles that you have to right. get through before you get to adult success. There are many stages of getting to that social and emotional development in a healthy adulthood. So I think those are the things that we need to measure, is what is that next transition we're trying to get the kid and family to.
Steve Stern, economist, circling back to some of the things that you told us at the beginning of the hour. This pilot study that you did for the greater Charlottesville area, the public mental health services available there, comparing need to what's available. By the most conservative estimates, I think you told us, that at best, about 50% of people who need help are able to get it.
That's correct.
And I think you also told us that this, what's thought of as the Region 10 area, is thought of one of the better areas in Virginia in terms of the degree of service available.
Yeah,
I think it might have been Donna Gum who mentioned earlier that Fairfax County is also thought of as doing very well and putting not only the available state funds, but a lot of local government funding. So there's a good chance that services are available to more people who need it there. You are about to embark on a statewide, region-by-region study. If I understand correctly, Stephen, to some degree in concert with this new commission headed up by State Senator Cree Deeds. So I want to ask you a question that I understand you're never supposed to ask a scientist. What are you expecting to find?
I shouldn't answer that question.
Okay.
I'm going to answer it, actually.
Yeah, based on what you've seen already, where would you predict that services are even less than 50% of need?
So I have a reasonable sense of what predicts the prevalence of mental health problems, and I don't think that's going to vary that much across different CSB regions, but the supply of services and the funds that are available to different CSBs is going to vary a lot. So those communities where the appropriation of funds for CSBs are a lot smaller are going to have much more of a problem than in the Region 10 area, and we're going to see some of those results be even more of a problem. Actually, I don't remember what the effect of ruralness is on mental health, but that might matter as well. So we might see more or less of a demand for services in more rural counties.
I think that particularly when you look at Southwest Virginia, the amount of poverty, it's one of the highest regions in the state in terms of child poverty. And also when you look at the problems with substance abuse, that's going to drive up the numbers in certain areas.
So substance abuse won't, because that's one of the outcomes. But poverty will, and the way that you expect.
Okay.
I think there are some other things that will, but I think the bigger thing is going to be the variation in supply.
Is one of the problems that this new commission is supposed to be looking at, and that in the long work that you've done in this area, Margaret Nimmo Crow, you were even once a chair of a regional services board in the Richmond area, the fractured nature of our mental health system in Virginia? Do you have some sense that there are places in the country where they do it quite differently and they get a better result?
Well, I think it's something that most of the country struggles with, quite frankly, as to how to get enough mental health services for the need and how to coordinate that between the public and the private sectors. No doubt there are some states doing it better, but I think there are a lot of states that are in the same boat that we are in terms of we have a very fragmented system. We have a lot of local variation. I am a bit encouraged when it comes to children, because the McAuliffe administration just formed what they're calling a children's cabinet, which is bringing together cabinet secretaries across the different sort of subject areas and state agencies to bring them together to work at a really high level on solving problems. And this is something that has proven effective in other states in terms of getting rid of some of those barriers that might exist between one bureaucracy and another. So in the McAuliffe Children's Cabinet, we're going to have the Secretary of Education, Ann Holton, the Secretary of Health and Human Resources, Bill Hazel chairing it. And it's also going to include Secretaries of Public Safety, Commerce and Labor, and another one I'm forgetting right now, but also the First Lady and the Lieutenant Governor, who's a pediatric neurologist, Ralph Northam. So we've got some really high-level people who are looking at children's issues from a lot of different angles and can bring all the resources of the state agencies under them to bear. So it doesn't have to get in the way of, well, your data system doesn't talk to my data system, or we only have funds to do this, but you have funds to do something else. They can sort of cut past all that, which would mire up many problems, and look at solving some of these high-level issues that cross these areas. And so certainly mental health is one of those issues that kids in the juvenile justice system, a huge proportion of them have untreated mental health disorders. We're dealing with mental health in schools, certainly in the Medicaid and health and behavioral health agencies. And from Commerce and Labor, they're really looking at the issue of early childhood. They're looking at Virginia's future workforce and how are we going to have a successful workforce to compete in the 21st century.
The
Donna Gum from Mental Health America.
Several areas, including Stanton and Waynesboro, conduct the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and every year that it's done still shows that children at a young age, it's done in the seventh grade and the ninth grade, show that these children are already having suicide thoughts. And
at what levels of prevalence do you know?
It's greater, I think, like in the ninth grade.
No, but I mean, are you talking about 5% of the student population, 2%, 10%?
I've not looked at the figures. I've just heard the report.
So you think that it's great enough to be concerned?
Yes.
So I want to also, before we get out of...
Any percentage is worth looking at.
Before we run out of time, Donna, I'm hoping we can get back to something that you mentioned early in the hour. The whole notion of dealing with stigma and overcoming stigma. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Stigma is a barrier to access to getting treatment. People don't want to admit that they have a mental illness, so therefore they're not going to say, you know, I need treatment. It is getting better than it used to be. It used to be a closet issue. In the last 10, 20 years, maybe, it's been better, but it's still an issue. A man wrote an article in the paper this morning. He's African-American. He also belongs to a church. He's faith-based. And in that community, you just don't talk about having a mental illness and seeking treatment. People say you just got to suck it up and go on. And this is why people end up committing suicide, oftentimes turning to alcoholism or to other drugs.
Steve Stern, I know that you're an economist, and you're approaching this mostly from that vantage point, but you also did a lot of volunteer work with the Community Services Board and served as its chair for a while. You've got thoughts on this issue?
I think stigma is a tremendous issue. Part of it is that there's a social aspect to it and feeling...
True.
But another part of it is, for lots of people, is there's a sense that you're not really... You have a character problem, that there's something broken about you that prevents you from just getting past that. And that's not true. that's not the reality of mental health problems, but I think many people feel that way.
People feel like they're going to be isolated if they avoid, if they do say that they have a mental illness, they won't be hired.
One, I think people also, parents are afraid of being blamed, that they're doing something wrong as parents if their children have a mental health disorder. But I think the important thing to understand is that none of that is true. These are biologically based illnesses, and, you know, you're no more at fault than you are at fault for getting cancer or diabetes or any other sort of physical health challenge that you might have. So I encourage everyone to get help if you think you need it.
I'm so sorry that we are out of time, but I do want to mention that our guests have been Stephen Stern, the Merrill H. Bankard Professor of Economics at the University of Virginia, Margaret Nimmo Crow, Executive Director of the group Voices for Virginia's Children, plus Donna Gum, Executive Director of the Augusta County Chapter of Mental Health America. Thank you all so much for making time for us.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you.
Podcasts of this program are available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you'll see links to more information about our guests, as well as a link to Dr. Stern's new study on measuring need for mental health services. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.